The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council welcomed to today's training, Remedy Selection for Contaminated Sediments. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover introductory material in the first few slides, and then I'm going to turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC Contaminated Sediments team. Today's training is based on the online guidance document, Remedy Selection for Contaminated Sediments. We're going to introduce you to the document during the training class, and we do hope this guidance is something that you can use after today's training. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We do record our training sessions. The trainers are going to control the slides today, but if you would like to, you can download the PowerPoint presentation so that you can look at whatever slide you're interested in. We do look for your questions and feedback throughout the training class in that Q&A box. You're welcome to send in questions or comments. At the question and answer break, we are going to ask some of those questions out loud. And if you're on the phone line, you can also unmute and ask questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone on the call to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the feedback that you provide. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you're interested in a certificate, after you attend the class, be sure to complete the feedback form. There's a box at the bottom to check to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate the certificate for you. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because right now the only way to get that certificate is by checking the box on the feedback form. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. The Contaminated Sediments team is typical of many ITRC teams. It's made up of state regulators, private industry, members from federal government, academia, and community stakeholders, as well as tribal stakeholders. You can read the full list of the team members in the Appendix B of our document. The full ITRC's disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have several new teams that just started this year, so it's your opportunity to become more involved in ITRC. We also have a wide variety of guidance document and training available. I'll introduce today's trainers. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team. That team was led by John Cargill from Delaware and Greg Newman from New Jersey. John Cargill is a hydrologist with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, located in Newcastle. Steve Clow is a senior environmental toxicologist at Haley and Aldrich in Manchester. Paul Duty is a principal engineer with Anchor QEA in Syracuse, New York. Eric Bliskey is a senior environmental scientist with CDM Smith in Portland, Oregon. And Bhavna Sharma is an environmental engineer with CH2M, now Jacobs, located in Gainesville, Florida. More information about our trainers is available on the CLUIN training page. You can read excerpts from their bios. On slide 6, I'll now turn the presentation over to John Cargill at the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. John?
Thanks, Juliana. I appreciate it. And we're going to start today's training with this poll question. And while you all are answering this poll question for us, let me just state that it's been a great honor co-leading this group of incredible experts that we put together to develop this guidance. And, you know, this is likely to be our last live offering of this training, so be sure to pay attention where Juliana mentioned the archives were. This particular session is being recorded as well as many others, so access will still be there for these. Now, this polling question, really, we're trying to get a sense of what our audience's experience level is with contaminated sediments. And it can help not only us in presenting the material today, but also kind of help you in understanding that across the country and other parts of the world. You know, that there is differing levels of expertise in dealing with contaminated sediments here. And from the answers today, it looks like we're kind of in the middle of the road. We don't have a lot of expert level folks on the call. We do have some folks that really haven't had any experience with sediments, and quite a few probably that have just a little bit. So this is really going to be informative for especially those folks, but our experts as well. You know, there's new information out all the time, and hopefully we can point you in the right direction for finding some of that info. Moving on to slide 7, I want you all to pay attention to the numbers here, not necessarily the colors. And the numbers represent numbers of fish advisories that different states have. This was from a database in 2011. But what's really important to know is that advisories do exist in nearly every state across the nation. And in a lot of these cases, maybe even the majority, the fish advisories exist because of the presence of contaminants in fish tissue. We're talking about contaminants such as mercury, PCBs, dioxins, chlorinated pesticides, those types that move up the food chain. It's quite alarming. And it should also really be no surprise to any of you when we say that contaminated sediments act as a source of contamination to overlying surface waters and the biota that live in the surficial sediments and in the water column and feed on things then and move up into different trophic levels. So really the key association here, key word that we want you to clue in on is bioaccumulation, which is a process infinitely connected to bioavailability. Our next slide, slide 8, is along those lines and maybe a shameless plug, if you will, for a previous ITRC Contaminated Sediments Team document, the Bioavailability and Contaminated Sediments document, that really introduces the concept of bioavailability. It contains a wealth of information about how to assess bioavailability when evaluating contaminant exposure pathways at contaminated sediment sites. Now, a lot of the remedial approaches we're going to talk about today, including capping and many of the in-situ technologies, really aim at reducing risk by addressing bioavailability. So really, this is another source that we think you all should be aware of. We do have the links there, and it's just another great resource that the ITR seems to put together. And really, to add some further benefit to today's training, a lot of our instructors, several of them, were members of that bioavailability team as well. And we've gathered them together along with a host of other experts from across the country to really to take advantage of their firsthand experiences and knowledge to develop this next training document that you're hearing about today. So moving on to slide 9, originally we had to ask ourselves, you know, why should we develop an ITRC sediment remediation guidance document? And the answers were many. Sediment sites are unique and they're often very complex. There's the potential for multiple sources, multiple contaminants, differing habitats, differing waterway use. It's very potentially very challenging, which really does tend to drive up the expense of remediation when we're dealing with contaminated sediments. The evaluation and selecting remedial options can be equally as complicating as defining the problem. And a remedy selection framework and comparison are up to this point relatively absent from current sediment guidance documents. And that's not to say that current guidance documents don't provide an abundance of really good and useful information about technologies. They do. But what they don't do is provide a comprehensive framework for evaluating a remedy at a site. Another way to put it, maybe a progressive comparison process. And we've provided that with this document. We'd really like to, in the process, you know, advance or move forward existing technologies and present the capabilities of new technologies, and this often requires a multidisciplinary approach. And looking back for a moment at the poll we just took at the beginning of the session here really indicates that this guidance is pretty important. So we were happy to do so and develop this guidance. Aside from some of the things I just mentioned, you know, there are a lot of reasons to use the guidance. you know, again, we've pulled together this unprecedented group of highly skilled individuals to give us their take on decades of firsthand experience. We're providing in this document tools to assist determining appropriate data necessary to select a remedy. We get into advancements in both old and new sediment remediation technologies that include monitored natural recovery, enhanced monitored natural recovery, in-situ technologies, capping technologies, and dredging and removal technologies. We're providing our users a platform to the latest information via a web-based document, so you can just kind of point, click, and go to where you need to go or want to go to get information. We'll talk today about a decision framework and some downloadable worksheets for site-specific evaluation and data retention at your sites. We'll introduce our technology assessment guidelines, which, you know, are just little guidelines that help our user most effectively use the information that we're providing. And again, we're going to get into this in a lot more detail here soon. We're going to provide some additional tools necessary to address applicability of remedial technologies to your site. And we're going to help you develop the right questions to ask yourself when evaluating different alternatives and selecting final remedies. And last but certainly not least, we've provided at least 88 case studies, different contaminants, different issues, different settings for reference in evaluating your own sediment site. So certainly of those 88, hopefully there's something similar to what you're working with, and you can see what's been done at those sites in the past. So moving on to slide 11, I mentioned this framework that we're going to introduce to you today. It is a six-step framework that includes, first, an evaluation of site characteristics or a review of site characteristics to ensure that you are collecting the right information to ultimately evaluate a remedy. We're going to get into zone mapping and development. An initial screening step to try to get rid of some technologies that you don't need to carry on further. A detailed technology evaluation with the data needs and technology assessment guidelines. We've got a step of developing alternatives and then evaluating those alternatives at the end. Slide 12. Now the important word here is the web document. What are the advantages of this web document? As I mentioned, this isn't a paper document. You can't pull it off the shelf and flip pages unless you print the PDF yourself. But what it is it's a user-friendly, online, comprehensive resource, a one-stop shop, if you will, that drives our users to information throughout the framework. You, again, just point, click, and go. It has a lot of function. So you'll see that with our technology overviews and within the framework as we talk about those further today. Now, I mentioned some worksheets. We've provided those in a downloadable form that you can use right on your desktop to retain information. You can document decision points throughout this whole remedy evaluation or selection process. And we're going to show you how we can do that or how you can do that with your own site-specific information, which is really what this is all about. And again, utilizing our guidelines that we've provided to help you through it. Now, lastly, we do offer advanced remedy evaluation beyond the 9 NCP criteria, which EPA typically follows. We do mimic those, as you'll see later, but we also get into several other areas that we feel it's good to evaluate. Slide 13. If you haven't gathered already the different advantages that you might get out of the training today, I'll point them out to you. First of all, we're gonna provide you with a full overview of the document content. Certainly not everything. It's a large document. We want you to really get in there and look at it yourself. But we're going to give you the highlights and kind of show you how to maneuver through it. We're going to show you about the functionality we've built into that today in order to get you from one place to another. Again, the kind of point, click, and go concept. We'll point out the areas where that's most effective. And then examples and guidance on how to use the decision framework most effectively. And before we move on, the one really good thing about today's offering or today's training is that you'll have the opportunity yourself to ask questions of us the folks who developed the document and try to get some of those specific questions answered as they come up today. Just use the Q&A pod here in the Adobe Connect, and we'll try to get you an answer today. All right, slide 14. After this training, we think, or we hope anyway, that you all are going to be able to identify site characteristics that need to be collected or be used in your evaluation and identify what other data needs you have. We anticipate that you're going to be able to evaluate your site and evaluate favorable technologies that might work at your site for remediating contaminated sediments. And then lastly, you'll be able to apply your expert know-how when this is all done. And the more you use this framework, the more advanced your skills will become and the more information you'll gather and start to be a little more comfortable with dealing with contaminated sediment sites. On to slide 16, any large document or guidance document like this requires some boundaries. So as a team, we talked a lot and came up with these following assumptions here that really kind of kick off where we begin our process of evaluating a technology or remedy. And those assumptions are that the nature and extent of your contaminants of concern originating from your site or other on-site sources have been characterized sufficiently in conjunction with a conceptual site model to support the whole remedy selection. We assume that a human health and ecological risk assessment has been completed for the site, and it's been determined that the site poses an unacceptable risk. We assume that other environmental endpoints that are to be protected have been identified, whether that be the benthic aquatic invertebrates or the pelagic, the fish, or whether it's humans that live, work, or otherwise utilize the waterway. We assume that contaminant loading by releases from site-related source areas or possibly even off-site source areas have been controlled, or at least the ongoing contribution of these releases has been determined and incorporated into your evaluation. And lastly, that remedial action objectives have been established in concert with some stakeholder input. So we know what we need to protect. We just need to figure out how to do that. So my last slide in the introduction before I hand it over to the next speaker who's going to start to get us into the weeds is to discuss real quickly this example site. We've developed a hypothetical example site that we're going to work through on today's training. Three of our presenters will build upon this example during the course of the presentation to kind of illustrate different features of the guidance and the usefulness of the functionality. Assumptions or at least characteristics for that site are that it's an industrial site. Our contaminants of concern are PCBs, lead, and chlordane. We do have some bulkheads present. We have some soft sediments present. There's some nice critical habitat areas. And we also have some debris and infrastructure that exists along the waterway. Again, remember our assumptions. The RI has been completed. The remedial action objectives have been developed. Our receptors in this case are the benthic invertebrates and fish, and we have identified and evaluated our source areas, and those have been controlled. So we'll utilize this example again to kind of run through some of the information that we're going to provide today and give you a good example of how it can work. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Steve Clow with Haley and Aldrich, who's a risk assessor. And Steve is going to start, like I said, kind of breaking through and getting us into the weeds on this contaminated sediment front. Steve?
Thank you, John. Nice to join everybody today. A little bit warmer up here in New England, which is nice. So slide 17, this is the training outline that we're going to be proceeding with today, and I'm going to review the site characteristics, the remedial zone identification and mapping, and a little bit on the spreadsheet for screening remedial technologies. As John said, this is a six-step framework, and I'm going to review step one through three. Step one is to review site characteristics, and one of the MOs for this document is that we wanted to proceed from the beginning with remedial strategies that go from the least invasive to the most invasive. So we'd probably start out with MNR and end up at dredging and filling or capping. So on a personal note, this is good timing because I've spent the last 4 years at the Hastings-on-Hudson site developing a baseline sampling and analysis plan. And that took a long time, and that's just getting the baseline. But if you don't have a good baseline, you have nothing to compare what your performance criteria are after the cleanup. So at that site in New York, we sampled surface water, sediment, pore water, lots and lots of fish. This is over a 2-mile reach, and we evaluated habitat. And we also, very important, is to make sure your conceptual site model, which is a living document, will support the RI and the remediation. And the conceptual site model should consider the source, the pathways, the receptors, root frequency, duration, sensitivity, et cetera, the time period, past, present, and future, and the fate and transport that's going on. And in the document, we divided the site characteristics into 4 genres, and that's the physical side, which would be, for example, debris from historical operations in the sediment, the bathymetry, the hydrogeology. Another genre is sediment, so we're looking at what are historical inputs and sources, the benthic community, scour zones, depositional zones. Interactions with the state and NOAA is very important. On the contaminant side, what is the nature and extent? And that, most people are thinking horizontal, but we need to know vertical too. If you have a lot of sediments that have accreted over the years, you need to know how deep they go and what contamination levels are usually most contaminated at the surface and decrease as you go down. But that can be opposite depending on what type of sediment deposition you have. And then land and waterway use, you want your source controlled on the land. You don't want to be filling in a clean hole with a dirty one. So source control is critical before you even think of starting remediation. And then what is the waterway use, such as you may have barges and canals, that create regular intervals of wave energy. And my basic rule of thumb here is that every time you check the box or you dip your toe in the water again, you're going to come out with more questions and concerns that you didn't anticipate. So you need to stay focused on your conceptual site model and your vision. So on the physical side, we have infrastructure, and this is one of the biggest unknowns. The infrastructure is probably responsible for most of the failures at a sediment remediation space. And that's because you have residuals that hang around under pilings and piers and bulkheads. So infrastructure will be a big problem with dredging if you have debris fields within your sediment also. So that's the physical side of infrastructure. And bathymetry is very important. This is your land underwater topo map. This should be done right at the outset, and possibly compared to a historical bathymetry map if you have one. And that will certainly identify debris fields and dams, and also help you understand hydrodynamics, because bathymetry and hydrodynamics influence each other. It's kind of a chicken and egg type of situation. The hydrodynamics at the New York site, we had very strong tides, a lot of scour. If you have an area where the river is meandering, you're going to have a lot of channel sinuosity, which will affect hydrodynamics and scour and deposition. Slope stability is important. It's strongly affected by hydrodynamics and the type of sediment you have in the littoral zone. Dredging will affect this zone and will also undermine bulkheads, so you need to be careful there. There's more on that in the document on this. And then groundwater and surface water interaction is very important. Again, you don't want to have dig up a clean site and have it recontaminated over time with low levels of contamination from groundwater input from upland. And then finally, habitat. You have sensitive habitats are critical, especially at this site where we worked. You have submerged eelgrass beds, which are sacred in New York. You want to save these at all costs. And we had other things like American sturgeon that we had to do habitat analyses for. So that's very important. On the sediment side, at Hastings site, we did sediment profile imaging and benthographs, which is this photo over on the right here. I'll get a little bit more into that later. But you on the benthographs, you want to know what your grain size distribution is. Do you have coarse sand, or most likely you're going to have silt or clay or some combination thereof? That's important from an engineering point of view and the type of benthic community that will populate the site. Potential for resuspension. I'm not an engineer, but there's something known as sed flume testing, where you can go out, take sediment cores, and bring them to the lab and test them under different hydrodynamic water conditions. Sediment consolidation is very important. The cap design, in other words, will the underlying sediment support some type of a cap? And then benthic community structure is critical. Again, we did SPI and benthic crabs here. We did a combination of them every single station. We did both the SPI and the benthic crab to see if they would correlate. And we sent the crabs, we sieved the crabs and sent the bugs preserved off to the lab, where they assessed abundance and diversity. And they calculated functional metrics like richness and pollution sensitivity or pollution-tolerant organisms. So these SPIs are really informative. You can see the benthic community in the top 4 centimeters or so. Then you have an oxidized zone, and then an anoxic zone. This black down here are ferric sulfides, and as you move up into the oxidized zones, these sulfides are reduced and into ferric oxides. So this is critical, certainly as far as the metals binding, too, if you're going to run AVS-SEM type of equilibrium partitioning. Slide number 21 is contaminants. I'm kind of a stickler for background. You really need to, an ideal sampling design for background samples is you want to get as many background samples as you have at the site. Now, that sounds a little bit rich, but I've seen studies where people have only taken, believe it or not, one background sample. And you can't do statistics that way. You want to be able to run ANOVAs and tell if there's a difference between contaminants upstream of your site and contaminants on your site. You can eliminate a lot of contaminants of concern that way. And I usually use an MO of like upstream, adjacent, downstream. I like to do like a 3-4-3 ratio or multiple thereof. Upstream influences. Stormwater culverts, your non-point pollution you have to get control of or get a handle of. CSOs, combined sewer overflows, if you have those, you probably have low-level PCB contamination. And then agricultural runoff, things like that. And contaminant types, you probably have PBTs or persistent bioaccumulative and toxic compounds such as PCBs, mercury, that type of thing. And so you, as John said, you want to consider bioavailability, the incorporation of bioavailability considerations into evaluation of contaminant sediment sites. That's a document through ITRC that's very informative. Ebullition is blebbing. You may have that in MGP sites, and this will mobilize PAHs, coal tar, things like that. So that's a big issue you have to be considerate of for contaminants at MGP sites. Distribution, what is the nature of extent, horizontal and vertical, I've gone over that. Bioavailability is critical. For organics, you want to look at your narcosis model or equilibrium partitioning model. There's documentation, US EPA has documentation, extensive documentation out for that. And then metals, you run AVS, SEM, and determine if divalent metals are bioavailable. And then there's always bioassays, too, which are critical. And then on the exposure, bioaccumulation, and biomagnification, those three really should have been taken care of in the risk assessment, so you should have a good handle on that. Land and waterway use. You want to know your current and anticipated uses. On the land side, you want to know what is the future of the upland site. Is it going to be commercial, industrial? Is it going to be residential condos? You might have a boardwalk there, all important from a risk perspective. And then on the waterway side, will you have a marina there? Is there going to be barge traffic that might affect your remedy? Are there ice flows in the winter, that type of thing? Site access is important. How will regular passage of cars and dump trucks affect the community during the remedial process? At Hastings, we had a very small entrance with a steep hill, and it really could present some problems in terms of health and safety. Watershed characteristics, you should contact FEMA. Are all of the flood zones defined? We've discussed CSOs and stormwater inflows, and then estuaries and what's your hydrodynamics like. Sensitive habitat and species, document all of your threatened, sensitive, or endangered species. You do not want to rip up a vegetated wetland just because it happens to be contaminated. And that you may have to do habitat assessments too, which can be very expensive. And then cultural and archaeological resources. This genre is rarely addressed, but I think it should be considered in a due diligence step. Step two is zone identification and mapping. So my MO here is divide and conquer. For example, if you have a large yard and you have a bunch of leaves, you're going to approach it maybe with three different remedies. You're going to mow to get the easy leaves. You're going to blow with your leaf blower. And then the hardest will be by hand. So you want to divide and conquer just based on the remedy and technology that you have available. That's just kind of a comparison, but it's a good comparison because when you're at a sediment site, you want to know which areas are, say, high energy erosion and low energy deposition. So if you have a meandering stream here, you want to be attentive to the hydrodynamics, and if you have a lower energy deposition area, that would be good for MNR. On slide 24, your approach for zone identification is you usually start with identification of contaminant distribution, and you'll compare those to sediment quality values, something like that. But you want to evaluate other characteristics too. For example, the results of toxicity tests. You may have done congener forensics in sediment or fish. You may have a high rate of sediment deposition in one area, and you may have done pore water and bioavailability in certain areas. So the number of zones will always be site-specific, and it'll be very simple to the highly complex depending on the different lines of evidence. In the example here, we have a depositional zone, which is on the convex side of a river, and before that, we have a groundwater flux zone. So that's just an example of two different zones that are kind of identified from 40,000 feet, so to speak. Slide 25, this is a zone delineation example where we worked at a site in San Francisco Bay. It was an MGP site on the landward side. It was a fairly uniform bathymetry, so we started out with a fairly simple grid, and the green column over on the right-hand side represented ambient. The middle column was a transitional zone, and the left-hand column was more concentrated, contaminated with MGP residuals. And then we used multiple lines of evidence where we looked at different pore water and biological responses of various metrics to determine a mixed remedy. So on the chemistry side, we had like pore water and in situ and ex situ body burdens of benthic invertebrates. On the biology side, we had benthic communities and caged mussels. And on the toxicity side, we had benthic toxicity. So it was kind of like a pretty advanced sediment quality triad. And then we use these pentagons graphics to explain to the client that we have same as ambient, greater than ambient, inconclusive, and they're not analyzed. And this allowed us to come up with a fairly structured remedy that was partly MNR because we did have sensitive CPENs as far as benthic invertebrates goes. And we had areas that we thought were contaminated that had a fairly robust benthic community. So that's just one example of zone delineation. Moving on to our example site that John talked about. So you want to start off with benchmark screening. So this is your simple binning. You bin your different contaminant concentrations according to do they fit into different sediment quality value, above or below sediment quality value benchmarks. So for PCBs, 2 to 60 would say be below a level that might cause impact to invertebrates. 61 to 600 might be between, say, a TEC and a PEC. And 601 is greater than that is contaminated. And you can see a lead and chlordane and PCBs just kind of, they co-varied similarly with each different remedy zone. So certainly the zone in the middle, they co-varied and you had a similar source there. And then drilling down to the lower oval here, which is zone 3, you can further evaluate zones based on a bulkhead area, and then a soft sediment and a habitat area, and then debris and sediment depositional area. So the depositional area might be marked out for, say, monitor natural recovery. And it's up to the engineers to decide, what's the best approach. And certainly you need to consider the fact that you're in an urban area and there may be interferences with remedial activities. So step 3 is screening of remedial technologies. Now, this is a downloadable spreadsheet within the document. And table 2-3 presents a spreadsheet that contains questions pertaining to each remedial technology. So the user yourself will fill in the cells with specific data and will help you to evaluate remedial technologies and determine their applicability. So this exercise will help you to eliminate one or more remedial technologies from further consideration. It's a little bit of work, but it's fun, and it gives you a vision of what your remedy should be. So this is an example of table 2-3 over on the left. You can see this is an example of the monitored natural recovery, which would be your first step because we're going from least invasive to most invasive. So the cell up at the top says concentrations of COCs in sediment and tissue are decreasing at a rate to meet REOs within an acceptable time frame. And the user has clicked yes and put a medium confidence on the radio button and put in a note that says trend over several decades is encouraging. Data is not frequent enough, however, to declare a high level of confidence. And then the third cell down says net sediment deposition rates are adequate to consider natural sedimentation as a reasonable alternative to meet REOs. The user has clicked yes and given it a medium level of confidence and put in a note that said the site is classified as depositional on state maps, but the rate of deposition is not yet known. And that you'll go through all these radio buttons for MNR, and down the bottom it says, based on these conditions, should MNR be retained for further consideration? And here the user has clicked yes with a high level of confidence, and the note says, fairly confident that once sediment is cleaned up to PRGs, the deposition of naturally occurring suspended sediment would keep concentrations low, which is really your classic definition of MNR. The next set would be rows for enhanced monitor natural recovery. So this is monitor natural recovery, but you usually enhance it with some type of a thin layer cap. So the cell, for example, the cell in the middle says characteristics of the site do not inhibit or prevent placement of enhancement materials. The user has clicked yes with a medium level of confidence, and they've put in applicable to zone 3, medium score since located in an urban setting. So after the user goes through all of these statements or questions, it comes down to, based on these conditions, should enhanced MNR be retained for further consideration? And the user's clicked yes. So both MNR and enhanced MNR in this case would be a viable remedial alternative for the site. And then, so you work through each one of these screening tabs, which includes questions addressing in-situ treatment, and we're going from least invasive to most invasive here, conventional capping, amended capping, dry excavation, and wet excavation. And when you get all through with all of these different remedial alternatives, you'll click to generate a remedial technology evaluation worksheet. And Paul Duty, who is our next presenter, is going to present more on this. He is a very competent and experienced remedial engineer with Anchor QEA, and he's going to show you more about the decisions you can make using this contaminated sediment remedy framework. So take it away, Paul.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Can you confirm you guys can hear me?
We can,
yep.
Yes.
Excellent. All right, well, thanks. So what I'm going to do is, Steve went through the kind of initial screening of technologies using that interactive worksheet, and after you went through that, you click generate the next step. And so that next step is to evaluate the remaining technologies in more detail, and I'm going to spend some time walking through that with you. But before we go, or before we start, I thought we'd maybe kick off here, wake folks up with another poll question, and just ask folks to kind of click on the technologies you've utilized previously, and maybe click all that might apply, and this will give us a sense for folks' experience level that we've got on the phone with the different technologies here. And what I'm seeing here, interesting, an awful lot of experience with MNR, which is pretty cool, and quite a few folks with in situ treatment experience. So a little surprising. I usually expect to see a lot of people with experience on the removal side, so this is pretty cool. Maybe we'll move on to the next step here. Or the next slide. So I'm on slide 34 for those folks that aren't online. So just a quick overview of what the evaluation of remedial technologies of step four is. It's outlined in section 2.7 of the guidance document. And in the document, there's a detailed section on each of the four basic types of cleanup technologies, the way we've organized it here. And I'll talk through each of these in a little bit more detail in the following slides. And the real objective of this step is to determine the most favorable technologies to then be used to assemble alternatives, either for each of the zones, if you've broken your site up into zones, as Steve had introduced, or for the site, if you didn't do that. And I think John had introduced this technology assessment guidelines. And I'm going to go through that in some detail, a unique aspect of this guidance document. So we're hoping that that's going to provide folks with a really good resource to help in evaluating the applicability and evaluation of the different technologies that are available. You may also, through this step, determine that you have some additional data needs to help you in either finalizing this detailed evaluation or in helping you assemble alternatives. So you may want to do a little bit of a do loop to go collect more data to help in subsequent evaluations. So we've got four basic technology groups, monitored natural recovery or enhanced MNR. Steve had mentioned both of those a little bit. That's described in section three of the guidance, in situ treatment, described in section four, capping in five, and removal in six. And under removal, we've got kind of hydraulic dredging, mechanical dredging, and dry excavation. And within each of the sections, we provide a description of each of the technologies. We provide a section on recent developments within that technology group. One thing I would point out to folks is when we say recent, this guidance was developed in 2014. We're here today in 2018, 4 years later, so I would encourage folks to do a little bit of research to see if there's been additional developments that have transpired since the guidance was developed. So just kind of recognize when things were originally developed in the guidance. Each section also has text and subsections on these technology assessment guidelines that we'll talk in more detail in a few slides. And then John had mentioned case studies. So we've organized our case studies in accordance with the different technologies. Make it easy for folks to go see, kind of what's been experienced at other sites with these technologies. That really can help in your evaluation as well. So I'll give a little bit of a quick overview just for definitional purposes as to the different technologies. MNR, which is monitored natural recovery, you can kind of think of it in the upland world, in the kind of soil and groundwater world, as akin to monitored natural attenuation. But basically, you're relying on different natural processes to help reduce the exposure to contaminants in the sediment, things like burial, mixing, you may have dispersion or degradation depending on the chemicals and the site-specific conditions that you have. And then enhanced monitored natural recovery, or EMNR, really is to apply a technology to enhance or accelerate those processes. A couple of examples here are application of a thin layer cap. So, you know, adding a 3 to 6 inch layer of clean material to accelerate perhaps the burial process, or adding some amendment. The figure on the right there shows the activated carbon being added to kind of accelerate the reduction in bioavailability to certain contaminants, and allowing the existing benthic community to kind of mix that material into the surface sediment. The next technology group is in situ treatment. I would say this is a pretty quickly evolving field, and probably one where my point before about the guidance document being developed in 2014, to do a little research to see what's developed. Things are, moving. There's quite a bit of innovation in this area, so I'd ask folks to do a little research before you run through this evaluation. But the basic concept is to add some amendment to the sediment to provide some either biological, chemical, or physical treatment of the contamination. I may do a combination of those treatment approaches. So some keys to success are you want to select the right amendment to facilitate that treatment. You want to be able to deliver that amendment and have it come into contact with the sediments and the contaminants that you're trying to treat, and recognize the limitations that you might have. The graphic on the right, a little simple cartoon, but been employed for solidification and stabilization, where you insert a caisson into the sediment and then have an auger that would inject and mix in a solidification agent. But the idea there is that you're applying and mixing the material in with the sediment in situ. And I mentioned it's an evolving technology. The use of activated carbon has been pretty well developed through pilot studies and full-scale studies, so you'll see that's pretty well developed, as well as solidification and stabilization. It was specified in the Gowanus Canal Record of Decision, and I know EPRI has done a pretty extensive pilot study with an evaluation of that technology as well. And again, there's more information on that in Section 4 of the guidance. Capping is a technology where the idea here is to place clean material over the sediment to serve one or more purposes. One might be to stabilize the contaminated sediment to keep it from being resuspended. You may be looking to isolate the contaminants in the contaminated sediment and keep them from migrating into the water column and into the biota. Or may also be looking just to physically separate the contaminated sediment from the benthic community, so providing a physical barrier. But the idea here is to place some clean material over the contaminated sediment to basically satisfy those one or more of those purposes. And I would say typically the materials that are used are maybe a sand type material or a finer grain material. So you may need to look at armoring of that material to protect it, to keep it in place in the long term. So you need to understand the forces that might be applied to the cap and evaluate whether armoring is necessary. You'll see on the bottom panel that photograph, that's actually kind of application of a marine armor mattress. It's kind of a probably the Cadillac version of armoring, but placement of either coarser grain materials, rock, riprap, or even these armor mattresses are options that you'd want to evaluate. You may also want to consider amendments to the cap material, and in an effort to either enhance the kind of chemical isolation characteristics of pore water that may be migrating up through the cap, and to enhance the adsorption or even treatment of the material running through the cap material. And also consider habitat. So you may be changing the characteristics of the bottom of the waterway, either with the capping material and or armoring, and to understand how that might change habitat and may offer you opportunities as well to enhance the habitat and the bottom conditions in some circumstances. The last technology group is removal. It's really the most commonly employed technology out there. We've broken removal into two basic categories of dredging, where you're removing the sediment through the water column, either through hydraulic dredging or mechanical dredging. The photograph on the right is a mechanical dredging operation with a clamshell, where you drop that down, grab the sediments, bring it up, and in this case, it's being placed in a barge for transport. And then the other option is excavation, and kind of the way we've defined that is if there's a way to isolate the area where you're planning on removing the sediments and are able to remove the water over the sediment and then allow yourself to excavate the material somewhat in the dry. I mean, it's still going to be a wet situation, but you would have the ability to remove the overlying water column so you have better visual observation and maybe able to use different equipment, more kind of typical standard construction and removal equipment. That's how we've defined excavation. When you're removing sediment, you need to make sure you pay attention to the support processes. Now that you've removed it, what do you need to do to either dewater or condition the material? How are you going to transport it? And finally, how is it going to be disposed? Are there options for beneficial use? So there's a kind of a full train of operations once you've removed the material and what you need to do to get it to its final disposition. And there's been quite a bit of work over the past couple of decades on some of the issues with removal, kind of characterize them in the four R's as they're affectionately referred to. Resuspension, when you remove sediment, you're going to inherently remove or resuspend some sediment into the water column. Residuals, you can't define every square inch of contamination, so you may find that you have contamination deeper than you expected, or through the process of removal and some of that resuspension, you end up with residual contamination on the surface after you're done dredging. So you need to consider that. And both of those processes could result in release of contaminants into the water and then be transported away from your dredging operation. And then, of course, the risk that may result from all of those operations. Okay, so within each of those different technology groups, we've, John had mentioned kind of a real unique aspect of this guidance is these technology assessment guidelines. And what we tried to do was where we could provide some quantitative guidelines or at a minimum where we could provide some qualitative guidelines of how each of these technologies might be impacted by the different characteristics at a site. And in the four basic categories that Steve had introduced earlier, and try to use simplified models, relationships, and for the most part was the experience of the folks around the table to provide some of these guidelines. And then the idea here is to compare the information and data you have for your site to these technology assessment guidelines to give you a better sense for the applicability of that particular technology at your site. And the intent here was to use these as practical guidelines in a weight of evidence approach and not really look at them individually in some pass-fail criteria. So really want to point that out to folks and make sure you consider that as you're working through the guidance. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on there's a table, an interactive table in the guidance document, table 2.4, which provides a nice navigation tool to each of the technology sections. As I had mentioned, each of the technology sections as a write-up on the technology assessment guidelines, and this table provides a nice way to navigate back and forth. And I'll take a little bit of time here to explain the table and then show you some of the navigability here. And this is just a portion of the table 2.4. It just shows the first six characteristics, physical characteristics, that Steve had introduced. And what you see on the we have columns for each of the different technologies, the MNR, EMNR, you see in-situ treatment. Capping, we've actually provided two different subcategories of more conventional capping, and then, as I mentioned, if you're amending the cap, we thought that was important to distinguish in some cases, and then you're dredging and excavation. And so for each of these characteristics, you'll see in the intersecting cell a designation. If you see that little, it's hard to read on the slide here, but the little tag emblem would mean that there is a technology assessment guideline for that particular characteristic. There's a designation of either an H, an M, or an L. And the idea here was that H meant that it was of high importance or critical importance. So those are the real important characteristics. The M is kind of moderate, or they're kind of a contributing factor. And then low would be kind of low or maybe even relatively unimportant factors. So you'll see tags primarily in the H and M, but in some cases the L's as well, where we could. And then you see a number within each of these cells. That number is the section number where, for instance, sediment stability under MNR is in section 3.4.1.1. It's a mouthful. So let me just show you a little bit of the navigability. So as an example, for sediment deposition rate under MNR, you'll see we've got a technology assessment guideline, and it's of high importance, and it's in section 3.4.1.2. So if you clicked on that, what that does is it takes you to that section. Wanted to show a little bit here that so for each characteristic and under each of these technologies, we have, you know, maybe one or two paragraphs of text describing how important and how that particular characteristic might apply to that technology. And then in the blue text is the actual technology assessment guideline. So you'll see that highlighted in blue font. And in this particular case, I don't mean to read this, but what you'll see is some important text to review, but in this particular case, you can see at the bottom of that first paragraph, there is a quantitative evaluation basically suggesting that, you know, sites with annual net deposition rates much greater than annual erosion and resuspension and with annual net deposition rates greater than roughly 0.5 centimeters per year are prime candidates for MNR, EMNR. So we tried to create something with a quantitative guideline there, but also couched within some text here that's very important for folks to review. Now, if we look at another example here, so a physical characteristic of presence of hard bottom and how that might relate to hydraulic dredging in the removal technology. You know, again, this is of high importance. There is a technology assessment guideline in section 666. We click on that, takes us to that section. And again, here we have, in this case, more qualitative description. So we don't really have a quantitative guideline, but you'll see it kind of broken up into three different areas where we describe the technology assessment guideline. So just wanted to give you a kind of a couple of examples here of a quantitative and qualitative tag. The idea here is to go through this for each of the physical characteristics, for each of the technologies, and then if you go back to Steve had introduced this spreadsheet, this interactive spreadsheet that's available online. After you've gone through that initial screening, what it will do is it will generate this next worksheet, this remedial technology evaluation worksheet, table 2.5 will be generated, and everything under the different technologies that remain after that screening will be blank. And the idea here is to, and this is a tool to be used. We're not suggesting to people exactly how you want to use it, but I guess what I would suggest to people is this is a place for you to kind of document your evaluation, and a place to create information that, let's say, you needed to go back to a year, 2 year, 5 years, 10 years later, would help you recall, you know, that evaluation that you had done. So kind of the guideline here that I would give folks is to populate this with that thinking that you may need to come back to it at some point. So put enough information in here to help you do that. And I think that'll vary by person. I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, but again, the idea here is, so for each of these physical characteristics, this one just happens to show the physical characteristics, and I'm just going to kind of highlight to folks how you might want to fill this out and how it works. This is going to take some time. I think for the zone 3 hypothetical example, when we went through this, we populated this worksheet, and we're estimating probably 40 to 80 hours of time to go through this. You've got a lot of characteristics, the number of technologies to review and compare that back to your site-specific information. So spend the time to do this. It's worth it. These contaminated sediment sites can be complex, can be quite costly to clean up, so it's really well worth the effort to do the homework up front and make sure you do a thorough evaluation. So just as a matter of example here, so one of the physical characteristics is sediment deposition rate. And so for MNR, our assessment was that the net deposition rate for zone 3 in our hypothetical site, it was a positive aspect for MNR. There was a high enough deposition rate that we felt that was a positive characteristic. Under presence of debris, there was quite a bit of debris in zone 3 in our site, so we felt that could be a significant problem for hydraulic dredging and could increase the level of resuspension we might see. So what you want to do is you want to go through each of these, and then you end up, if you look down at the bottom, you'll see this kind of an overall summary after you've gone through all of the different characteristics for each of these technologies. You want to do an overall assessment of each technology for that particular grouping of characteristics. So kind of under physical characteristics for MNR, we felt overall kind of a weight of evidence, again, were favorable. And then there's a cell for you to enter notes. And here we indicated that stability, deposition, and geochemistry are favorable for MNR in zone 3 of our site. When you click favorable in this spreadsheet, it generates the green background in that notes column. And under the removal hydraulic dredging, we felt the physical characteristics were unfavorable based on the significant debris. And when you do that, it populates an orange background. And if you click moderately favorable, you can kind of see some of these are yellow. So the idea here is you go through each of these, all of the characteristics within each of the characteristic groups or characteristic types. As Steve introduced, there were four of those different types, and I think there's a total of like 34 characteristics. So you can kind of do the math that you could be looking at entering information in, you know, 200 to 300 different cells. So again, this could take some time. Spend your time and be thorough in this. And when you get through all of the characteristics, you generate a report, you click on that, and that generates a nice summary report. And this is used in the next step, but gives you a kind of color coding, brings over those notes that you entered in, provides a nice little summary table that then can be used in the development of remedial alternatives and evaluation of those alternatives in the next step. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Eric Blitzke from CDM Smith. He's a senior environmental scientist who's got well over 25 years of experience. But I think before we do that, if I'm not mistaken, we do have a kind of a formal Q&A session here.
That's right, Paul. Thanks. We are going to take a few minutes to answer questions at this point in the presentation. So everyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod to send in questions. If you're in the phone line audience, remember to unmute. It's #6 to unmute, and you can jump in anytime with a question. Before we get to questions, I do want to remind everyone, at the end of the training class, we do look for you to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide, and everyone on the call is encouraged to provide feedback. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for today's training. So in the related URLs, that last item, feedback, you select feedback, select browse to. At the end of the class, be sure to fill out the feedback form. If you are interested in a certificate, check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and once you submit, the system's going to generate the certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get that certificate is by filling out the feedback form and checking that box at the bottom. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, and the system will generate that certificate for you. So we've had a couple questions come in, and I know our trainers have answered these online, but I do want to ask them for the benefit for everybody in the audience. A couple people have asked about these interactive tables. How do we access those?
I can cover that, Juliana. This is John Cargill. If you go to the web-based document on the ITRC webpage, there will be a contents tab on the left, and it basically is, it just kind of breaks down the different sections. Under section or below section 9, there's some text there that says list of worksheets, tables, and figures. The easiest way to get those worksheets is to click on that list of worksheets, tables, and figures. It will open up to another page here, or over on the right-hand side, the page will open up, and the very first item under the list of worksheets is the downloadable interactive remedial technology worksheets. So you can find them there.
And so when we download that and open it up, we see that screening that Steve showed us, and that was back on slide 29. So how do we get to what Paul talked about?
Well, the worksheets are interactive, and they build upon each other. In that case, if you go through the initial screening step and rule out a couple of technologies and then generate your next worksheet, it will eliminate from the evaluation worksheet anything that you've already decided screened out. If you want to retain all of the different remedial technologies, you can just click yes, I want to carry over all of them, hit generate the new worksheet, and it will bring the second one up, which is what Paul started with. So one builds upon the other.
Thank you. We've also had a couple questions about cost. Does the guidance provide any information on developing costs for implementing the different technologies?
I'll try to answer that one as well.
Yep.
As a regulator, there's obviously differing views, and I think part of my answer to that question was, you know, cost is certainly a factor, but it's more of a factor depending on who you represent. But certainly cost is a major factor in here, and we'll go into that some in the next part of the presentation, so I won't ruin it now.
Good answer, John.
A couple questions related to the worksheet. So are the colors in the evaluation worksheet automatic based on entry rank, or do the users input the color?
Yeah, that's automatic. So when you click on whether it's favorable, moderately favorable, or unfavorable, then that color automatically populates.
It's not going to automatically populate based upon the information you put into each cell. You have to, as the user,
right,
click whether the information you put in the cells leads you to believe that it's favorable, unfavorable, or moderately favorable. So it's a user-defined, not an automatic based upon what you've put into the other cells. But based upon which radio button you click, it will automatically change colors, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Can you comment on why it is so important to evaluate all the remedial technologies?
Anybody else want to take a stab at it?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that, you know, you may decide in early screening and in the step that Steve went through to screen out some technologies for some, you know, either very, very obvious reasons that you may not want to carry forward one or more of the technologies. So you do want to at least consider all of those in that initial screening. And then those that pass that screening, you definitely want to evaluate each of those remaining alternatives in detail to make sure that you're really thoroughly assessing how each technology might apply at the site and might satisfy your objectives at the site as well. I think it's really a thoroughness question to make sure that you've really thoroughly evaluated and not just quickly cast something aside.
Yeah, our whole idea there was that we're trying to drive folks to evaluate remedies at a site based upon the science and the technology and the data you have. We'll call it a data-driven assessment. The cost and some of these other factors come into play during evaluation of those. But first, you need to know what's actually going to work at your site or what could work, and then carry it on into a further evaluation of some of the more subjective or regional or political type considerations that are going to change whether you go one way or another. But first and foremost, we're trying to get you to a data-driven selection of what's favorable for the site, not taking any of those other things into consideration. So for that reason, it's good to evaluate them all.
And I think it's good also to have a record of the technologies, not only that you carried forward, but technologies that you didn't include and why.
Good point, Eric.
Yep.
How does the core permitting impact this type of work?
Core permitting meaning, well, Corps of Engineers permitting?
I would assume so.
Yes. Yeah, it's CORPS, so that's how I read it, the question.
I think that the core permitting, certainly permits are going to be required depending upon what type of waterway you're working with. You know, these technology evaluations will work from anything from a small pond all the way up to a large lake or river system. So depending on jurisdictional boundaries of the waterway you're working in is going to be dependent upon or is going to drive what permits you need and from who, whether it be the Corps of Engineers versus a state agency for that matter. So it's hard to answer that question.
Yeah, as I was going to say, it's pretty site specific, but I think that the, you know, the next section that Eric walks through, you know, that's probably where the evaluation of each of the alternatives and how that core permitting might play in would be a little bit more applicable. In the evaluation of the different technologies, certainly the waterway use, it may play in there as well. If this is a kind of a navigable waterway, you'll see some information in the guidance on how that might affect the selection of different technologies at your site or in that zone of your site that you're evaluating. So probably in a couple of places, but it may be kind of overall permitting and regulatory requirements plays more in the evaluation of the actual alternatives. That's kind of the next step.
Yeah, I think that's something that could be considered definitely during the implementability evaluation, but oftentimes with permitting, you know, it's really more of an implementation or design consideration where, you know, the permitting agencies typically are going to want to have detailed designs before they're going to issue a permit for your action. And at the feasibility study, you really probably don't have the level of detail they're going to want to see.
And for permitting, you want to get your permit in early rather than later. It's a long process.
It's a long process, yeah.
We had a question that came in back on slide 21. Can you explain how to sample for ebullition and how to read the results?
Okay, ebullition, that's a good question. You can get ebullition traps if you know exactly where the blebs are coming up. But, you know, I think if you have ebullition, it's usually an indication of some fairly egregious NAPL that's underneath your sediments. So that, at least every state I've worked in, they, if they have ebullition, they require removal in that area. I addressed it mainly because it can be a source of additional contamination that could spread further if it's not controlled. So, you know, it can be simple as walking a site and sticking a probe into the sediment and see if gas comes up, and if it does come up, is there sheen with it? But the sites that I've worked at, we usually have a yes or no type of criteria. It's either there or it isn't, and if it's there, something needs to be done about it. Maybe some of the engineers can speak into this, but wherever I've seen ebullition, it usually indicates that NAPL is moving or has the potential to move, and so it needs to be removed.
Yeah, and I would say ebullition by itself isn't necessarily an issue, because you could have naturally occurring organic material that would cause ebullition. But
right.
Really, the question is it a transport pathway? So if you have ebullition and sheen bursts and things like that, then that's indicating that it's creating a transport pathway for NAPL to move into the water column or something like that, and it's
right.
likely going to have to be addressed.
Yeah, agreed.
Yep.
Is there a guidance on site characterization and screening for sediment?
I think there are quite a few guidance documents specific to certain things out there. And our document's going to drive you or direct you to a lot of those resources, probably in like the technology overview sections. We might link you to other documents that go into more of the site characterization modes. That's the short answer to that.
Thank you. We're out of time for this question and answer break, but participants are welcome to keep sending in questions throughout the second half of the training class. In some cases, the trainers are going to look at those and answer online, and we'll also hope to have time at the end of the class today to ask more questions out loud. We'll continue on now with the next section of our training class, and I am going to turn it over to Eric Bliske at CDM Smith. Eric?
Okay, thank you. Good questions, everybody. Nice to have that kind of dialogue. So I'm on slide 49, and I'm going to talk about steps 5 and 6 in the remedy selection and evaluation framework, which is the development and evaluation of remedial action alternatives. So kind of looking at our flow chart here, you kind of move in, you can see where we are, step 5 and 6. And really what I'm going to cover here under step 5 is basically the evaluation of remedial technologies and the assembly of those technologies into remedial action alternatives. So I think, you know, Steve and Paul did a great job talking about, you know, how we would screen technologies and evaluate technologies. And I'm going to talk about how those technologies that are determined to be the most favorable at your site, again, based on site-specific characteristics, can be built into remedial action alternatives. Now, we can do this on a zone-by-zone basis. So if you have, you know, very differing conditions, that might work, or you could do it as a site as a whole. So it's really depends on the complexity of your site and the differences in your various zones. So before I get into all that, I'm going to kind of do a little bit of review and talk about kind of how we got to where we are. So thinking about the example that Steve and Paul touched on, you know, we did an initial zone identification based on contaminant distribution. Then we refined those zones based on site-specific conditions, and we had, you know, different zones, different subzones, I guess, in these different remedial zones. And then thinking about zone 3, which is what we're going to focus in on, we identified 3 subzones based on infrastructure, you know, the bulkheads, sediment strength, you know, the ability of the sediment to support a cap, perhaps, presence of debris, depositional areas, things like that. So we take that information and we start to kind of, again, apply our technologies, build our alternatives. So you can see here in this bulkhead area, that's an area where, you know, maybe difficult to dredge because of, you know, the bulkhead. Dredging up against the bulkhead could cause the bulkhead to collapse. While that's not an insurmountable thing, it definitely makes dredging a little more difficult. In areas where we have soft sediment or habitat, we're going to have to take into account, you know, the sediment strength to support a cap. Maybe there's certain types of design considerations that are going to come into play there. If we do have a habitat that's valuable, more aggressive technologies will disrupt that habitat. So maybe we want to do something a little less invasive in that area. Where we have deposition, you know, that's going to favor natural recovery processes, whether that's enhanced natural recovery or M&R. And then if we have debris, of course, that will perhaps limit the effectiveness and increase short-term impacts associated with dredging-based technologies. So when we went through the whole screening step, we didn't really eliminate much. The only thing we eliminated was excavation in the dry due to water depth and the difficulties associated with, you know, dewatering deep water and getting in there and being able to remove material under dry conditions. But every other technology was retained. And then as Paul described, you know, we went through our technology evaluation process, and you can see here, you know, based on our site characteristics, technologies that rely on natural recovery were generally favored. You know, we have a lot of green over on that left-hand side of that table. Then when you get into capping or in-situ treatment, it's kind of a mix of green and yellow. So that's slightly, a little bit less favorable than M&R and enhanced natural recovery, but still, you know, pretty good. And then when you get into removal, you know, things are going to be a little more difficult, in particular for hydraulic dredging due to maybe the presence of debris, lack of site access, because if you're going to do hydraulic dredging, you're going to have to pump the material somewhere and dewater it. You know, there's a lot more involved. But it's not to say that we shouldn't rely on removal if necessary. It just means it's a little more difficult to implement than perhaps less invasive remedial technologies. So when we're trying to build our alternatives, you know, we've brought forth all these different technologies that we think would work, and now we need to kind of evaluate them in a broader context. So I think the first step is to really assemble, you know, begin assembling these different technologies into remedial action alternatives. And we want to make sure we're covering a range of these technologies from least aggressive to more aggressive. So make sure that we're looking at not only, you know, M&R and enhanced natural recovery, but also removal and capping-based technologies. As an initial step, you know, when we're kind of building the alternatives, we need to confirm that those alternatives will, in fact, achieve the remedial action objectives that we established for the site. Now, I think it was John that talked about, you know, we assume that those have been established based on stakeholder input, but we still need to make sure that our technologies can achieve the goals. And I think in this example, you know, we determined, again, this is an example, but we determined that M&R was not going to be effective, would not achieve our remedial action objectives within a reasonable time frame. And so we've kind of eliminated that technology from our alternative development process. Similarly, when we looked at the implementability of removal in that bulkhead area, we determined that, you know, because of site infrastructure and other considerations, that dredging along the bulkhead, you know, was not going to be implementable. And so that technology was eliminated from our alternative evaluation, or excuse me, alternative development process. So we kind of went through that whole step, and then we just, again, try to come up with a range of alternatives. So you can see here in that bulkhead area, we eliminated dredging, as I mentioned, but we left in, you know, different types of caps, a conventional cap or reactive cap, and then we retained in-situ treatment as well. In that soft sediment area, we retained in-situ treatment, a conventional cap, and then a dredge and cap kind of base remedy. And then remedial zone 3, which is a depositional area. Again, we can maybe get away with enhanced natural recovery in this area, thin layer sand cover, in-situ treatment, and a conventional cap. And so you can see that for these three different areas, we've got three different, again, this is a very simplified example, but we've got three different technologies we're applying in different areas, you know, ranging from something that's relatively simple to implement, like enhanced natural recovery, to something a little much more complicated, like a dredging and capping-based remedy. Now, I think in reality, you might be really coming up with combination remedies that rely on a lot of different types of technologies, and there might be a little more precision you want to bring to the alternative development process. But for this example, we're trying to keep it, you know, relatively simple, relatively high level. So once we've assembled our alternatives, now we got to evaluate them. And the thing I want to stress about this is that the alternatives need to be evaluated according to the regulatory framework you're operating in. And, you know, when we were developing the guidance, we didn't assume that this was going to be a CERCLA cleanup or some kind of state cleanup or whatever, but, you know, we wanted to come up with something that was applicable to whatever remedial framework you're operating in. But it's important that you recognize that the way you evaluate your alternative is going to be dictated by the regulations you're operating under. The second thing is that even though we have different regulatory frameworks out there, they typically will require evaluations of long-term effectiveness, so that's the ability to achieve the remedial action objectives over time, short-term impacts during implementation, so this is if you're out dredging, you know, what kind of releases are to the water column are occurring, or even during a cap placement, implementability, which would take into account site structures, perhaps, you know, docks and things like that, the availability of services, permitting, we talked a little bit about that. So which technologies are going to be, or which alternatives are going to be most implementable, and then, of course, cost. Cost is obviously a key factor. I think no matter who you work for, right, we want remedies to be, you know, cost effective. And then, like I mentioned before, the exact criteria is going to be dependent on the regulatory requirements you're operating under. The other thing to keep in mind is there may be modifying criteria that come into play. You know, under CERCLA, you have state and community acceptance, which are identified as modifying criteria. But there are other factors as well, including sustainability and green remediation. And so those are going to have to be or should be considered in your evaluation process. So as I mentioned, you know, it was kind of a challenge for developing the guidance because, you know, it wasn't applicable to a single regulatory framework. So what we did was we came up with what we called evaluation principles and criteria. And I think the number one evaluation principle is to focus on achieving the remedial action objectives and net risk reduction. So the idea is that, you know, we want to implement remedies that focus in on reducing risk. You know, it's not necessarily removing mass, but we want to be able, at the end of the day, make sure that our alternatives or the selected remedy will reduce risk. And that we're going, as part of that evaluation process, we need to evaluate the degree of risk reduction both at the end of construction, which we call time equals zero sometimes, and over time considering, you know, natural recovery processes. And I think there is a recognition that natural recovery or monitored natural recovery is a component of all or most sediment remedies. I mean, generally, you know, we're not cleaning up everything. We clean up kind of areas of higher contamination and allow natural recovery to deal with areas of lower contamination. The second principle is to maximize long-term risk reduction while at the same time minimizing short-term impact. So this is kind of trying to find that sweet spot, trying to balance the idea of doing very aggressive remedies, which may be very effective over the long term, may, you know, reduce risk, but also may cause a lot of short-term impacts, whereas we do something maybe that's a little less aggressive, you know, again, maybe it's still protective, but it doesn't have the same kind of short-term impacts. But the flip side of all that is that if we're less aggressive, we might not be able to achieve our goals. So, you know, we have to make sure we achieve our goals, but we also want to minimize short-term impacts during implementation. So I have a couple, a little examples of kinds of evaluations that people can do. This first one looks at reductions in fish tissue concentrations associated with a range of remedial action alternatives at time equals zero. So this is doesn't take into account any kind of natural recovery and really looks at the ability of these alternatives to meet a fish tissue target concentration of 0.05 parts per million. So you can see with alternatives 1, 2, and 3 that we don't quite get there. And another thing to point out about this chart here is that we've taken into account some of the uncertainty in these predicted fish tissue levels. So you can see we have these different error bars. So for alternatives 1, 2, and 3, we don't quite get to 0.05, even taking into account those error bars. But then when we look at alternatives 4, 5, and 6, again, we're spending more money here, but now we're able to actually, you know, at least taking into account these error bars, achieve that fish tissue target goal. And again, this chart does not take into account any kind of, you know, natural recovery. But the next one does. So the other thing to think about is years to achieve protectiveness. So, you know, here's where we have a series of alternatives. We have a remedial goal there, it's a sediment concentration, and we're evaluating how many years it'll take for us to achieve that remedial goal. So you can see that, you know, for the first 10 years, really only alternative 6 will get us down below that goal. But once we get into that 20 to 30 year range, we're starting to approach that goal with most of our alternatives. The thing, too, to keep in mind is that as we move further out along that time scale, the alternatives kind of start to collapse upon themselves. So it's hard to distinguish, you know, these long-term, you know, risk reduction estimates, taking into account natural recovery between the different alternatives. So it's just something to consider as we're thinking about, you know, trying to thinking about uncertainty in our predictions and things like that. You know, we might be trying to predict, hey, it's going to take us 25 years to achieve our goals, but we might not be able to distinguish between one alternative or another in that evaluation. A few other evaluation principles. I think this next one is actually really important from my perspective. I kind of touched on it before, but it's really making sure that we address areas of contamination that might be ongoing sources to the water body. So the idea is that, you know, we have sources of contamination. They could be upland sources, but we're really talking about in-water sources of contamination that limit the effectiveness of natural recovery. And we need to, kind of actively remediate those areas to increase the effectiveness of natural recovery. And that the more of those areas we actually address, you know, the more effective natural recovery is going to be. And the big question is, given the uncertainty in any kind of natural recovery predictions, is, you know, how big of an area do we need to address? But generally, these areas are, you know, can be active sources of contamination and can inhibit natural recovery processes. And then along the same lines of that, you know, making sure that we acknowledge and manage our uncertainty, because, you know, we may not really know how big of an area to actually get in there and actively remediate because we're relying on predictions. So maybe we should think about, you know, adaptive management frameworks where, you know, we try something, we target an area of contamination, and then we monitor the effectiveness of that action in terms of achieving our remedial action objectives, but also have contingencies in place to take additional actions if necessary. So it's not a matter of just sort of doing something and hoping for the best, that we have a more formalized adaptive management framework that outlines what you're going to do, how you're going to monitor effectiveness, and then what you're going to do if you don't achieve your goals. The final evaluation principle, I think, is balancing cost against overall effectiveness. So this is something that comes really right out of the NCP, where it talks about all remedies should be, shall be, I think it uses that term, shall be cost effective, and that cost effective is based on an evaluation of cost against overall effectiveness, where overall effectiveness is related to long-term effectiveness and permanence, short-term impacts, and then reduction in toxicity and mobility and volume through treatment. But the idea is that we want to make sure that we're implementing remedial measures that are cost effective, and that, you know, we're making sure we're considering all these other kind of factors that we go into evaluating effectiveness, but we're also making sure that we're considering cost appropriately. Another element of the guidance in terms of this remedy evaluation process is kind of thinking about how to, I guess, weight the various benefits of your remedy. Now, some things that you're evaluating in your remedy, in your alternative evaluation process, I guess, can be pretty quantitatively estimated. So measuring, you know, estimating post-construction concentrations or risk, measuring, estimating cost. I mean, we can do a pretty good job on that. Some others are less quantitative, maybe more qualitative. So that would be implementability, concerns of the community, maybe short-term risk. So you want to kind of try to maybe assign a weight to those different factors and then, you know, evaluate them against cost. Now, there is a little bit of subjectivity that can come into play here. And so, you know, I think these kind of tools need to be used with caution. But the important thing on this slide to note is that the alternative, alternative E, that is the most costly, is not necessarily the best from the standpoint of all the other evaluation criteria. So these kind of tools can be useful in illustrating, you know, why you selected a certain remedy by, you know, again, trying to quantitatively, if you will, estimate some kind of overall benefit associated with the remedy. So kind of to kind of wrap up here, in terms of evaluation principles, you know, number one, you have to address your specific regulatory requirements. So those are, again, using the CERCLA terminology, threshold criteria, balancing criteria, and modifying criteria. But another key element is managing risk, right? I mean, once we get into remedy selection, there is really a risk management process, and we need to think about the uncertainty in our predictions of risk reduction, especially if we're looking at long-term risk reduction estimates. And then we need to understand the cost implications of, you know, doing more or doing less. Another thing to keep in mind is understanding the role of other regulatory frameworks in achieving a watershed goal, right? So I think a lot of times with these contaminated sediment sites, you've got maybe fish tissue concentrations that pose risk to human health. Maybe those have triggered fish consumption advisories. Maybe that's triggered, you know, water bodies being listed as impaired and TMDLs and things like that going forward. So we need to recognize that while we're going to be doing sediment remediation and that can provide a lot of benefit, other controls, stormwater controls, other types of watershed controls can help help the water body recover as a whole. And I think the other piece to keep in mind here too is that, you know, stormwater and CSO discharges can recontaminate your remedy. So in many cases, these things need to be controlled before you go ahead and implement your remedy. You don't want to go out and spend, you know, $500 million or something like that doing a big sediment cleanup and have it get recontaminated. I touched on it a little bit before, incorporating green and sustainable remediation concepts. There is an ITRC guidance document on that that's available and is listed here. But it's just important to understand the overall impact of your remedy. And, you know, we're actually working on a site right now where we're looking at in situ treatment, and we're looking at, you know, different types of activated carbon sources to use for that process. And it turns out that if we use regenerated activated carbon, you know, the environmental footprint of using that technology, that source material rather than new activated carbon, you know, is significant. So again, there are ways to design and implement your cleanups to make them more sustainable and reduce the overall environmental footprint. And then finally, incorporating habitat and resource restoration into the cleanup. I'm a real big believer of doing this. There are regulatory frameworks in place that, you know, require, you know, mitigation under the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act that can help, improve the habitat friendliness of your remedy, maybe. There's also natural resource damage assessments and restoration activities that can be implemented under NERDA. Those kind of measures to make your remedy a little more habitat friendly, I think, can do a lot in terms of really restoring the water body, because it's not just about reducing risk. You know, if we come in and put down a really heavily armored cap, you know, there may be adverse impacts to the aquatic environment for many years associated with that. So how can we design and implement these remedies so that they're a little more aquatic habitat friendly? So using the right kind of material in the cover of your cap, for example, to, you know, improve, you know, right riparian and shallow water habitat. So I think those are important considerations that can be brought into play here. So kind of at the end of our example, you know, we went through a long process in terms of identifying the contamination, the distribution, our remedial zones. We screen our technologies. We evaluate our technologies. We assemble and evaluate our alternatives. And at the end of the day, we have to, you know, select something. So in this example, remedial zone 3, the bulkhead area, we selected conventional cap. We determined that would be sufficient to meet our remedial action objectives over the long term. We determined that in-situ treatment by itself wouldn't be effective, you know, but we needed to, add this capping element. In remedial zone 3, again, where we had the soft sediment, we determined that, you know, a cap might not be effective. This was a habitat zone as well. Maybe that would be a little too disruptive to the habitat. But we were able to determine that in-situ treatment would meet our goals, would reduce these habitat impacts, and was really an easily implementable remedy. And then within our depositional zone in area 3 here, we determined that monitored natural recovery by itself would not be effective, but that enhanced natural recovery through a thin layer sand plate cover placement or something like that would meet our goals, would be implementable, and would be cost effective. So with that, I'm going to wrap up, and I'm going to pass it over to Bana Sharma, and she's going to from Jacobs Engineering, and she's going to talk about monitoring the effectiveness, long-term effectiveness of our remedies.
Thank you, Eric. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. And thank you, everyone, for staying with us so far. Now we will talk about monitoring, which is Section 7 of the guidance document. And so based on this training so far and our discussion on remedial selection and evaluation framework, and also based on your own project experience, you might have recognized the need of monitoring at every stage of the project. So in this section, we will go through a planning process that can be used to develop an effective monitoring plan. And this ITRC recommended planning approach is based on EPA's data quality objectives process, and it incorporates EPA sediment remediation guidance, Navy sediment guidance, and other resources that are all listed there in the document. So for any remedial action, as Steve, Paul, and Eric just discussed, be it in-situ treatment, capping, dredging, MNR or EMNR, baseline monitoring, it's required to understand the baseline conditions prior to remedy implementation or prior to compliance monitoring in case of MNR. Then during construction, monitoring is required to measure important variables such as turbidity associated with resuspension or to determine if the design criteria have been met. Then post-remediation monitoring, it is required to determine if the remedy is performing as expected or to evaluate the long-term effectiveness. So here we will talk about monitoring timeline, and this figure shows how monitoring fits into overall time frame and emphasize on pre-remedy, remedy implementation, and post-remedy monitoring. But before we go into detail, here I would like to distinguish between characterization efforts and baseline monitoring. Characterization efforts are usually a part of remedial investigation that takes place prior to considering remedial alternatives. And the data needed to understand the risk, to identify the remedial footprints, or to select remedial alternatives may or may not have selected the specific metrics or time frames or even parameters that we may plan to use for evaluation of long-term effectiveness. For example, if we want to select an advanced measurement method for long-term monitoring, maybe like a passive sampler, or would like to use any specific organism to measure the bioavailability of contaminant, we may not have used that during site characterization. So during baseline monitoring, we want to make sure that we use the same select metrics and time frames prior to remedy implementation so that we can make proper comparisons and can measure the effectiveness over time. So, and as Steve emphasized in the beginning, it's very important to set up a very strong baseline condition. Construction monitoring, it typically takes place during or immediately after remedy implementation. It is used to determine if the design criteria have been achieved and if construction-specific performance metrics have been achieved. For example, in case of capping projects, we want to make sure we have achieved uniform cap thickness or the required cap thickness. And in case of dredging, we want to make sure we have achieved required dredging depth. And it is also used to determine if the control measures are met, such as turbidity controls, or other water quality parameters are at required levels. Then post-remediation monitoring, it takes place after remedy implementation. It involves regulators and a stakeholders' approval process, and this may include performance monitoring to determine if the physical and chemical conditions that we are trying to achieve with the remedy implementation have been met, such as surface sediment concentrations are now at acceptable levels or not. Our effectiveness monitoring, it covers long-term data that will show progress towards meeting the actual remedial action objective. For example, bioavailability of contaminants or ecosystem recovery, these might be the measures that we want to demonstrate that the remedy has been effective. Now, here we will start a discussion about the six-step planning process for planning and designing the monitoring program. And this is the process that I just mentioned. It's based on EPA's data quality objective process, and it incorporates EPA and Navy sediment guidance documents. And in this slide, we will discuss about stating the objectives and identifying the measures that are needed. So this basically helps us planning a structured and a strategic well-thought approach for our monitoring program. So here what's recommended is that the objectives be stated as specific questions that will be answered using the monitoring data to be collected. So we should list the questions to be answered for each of the monitoring phases, baseline, construction, and post-remediation. And once these questions are established, then process requires to determine the specific measurements that will be needed to answer these questions. So in general, these measurements include physical properties, concentrations of contaminants in various media, and biological characteristics. And in some of the cases, it may involve biases that can be used to demonstrate reductions in toxicity over time. The specific questions and associated measures selected, they can be highly dependent on the unique conditions of site. Same technique can be relevant for different systems like rivers, streams, lakes, ponds, but physical property varies. So we need to consider that during our monitoring plan. For example, for a given site or selected remedial option, hydrodynamic conditions may be important, but for other side or other option, it cannot be like a dominating parameter. And as we just discussed, like ablation could be important parameter for MGP site. So we need to account for all these different variables during planning and designing the monitoring program. The next two steps in this process are to specify boundaries for the monitoring program and to specify how the measurements are used. Now, boundaries explain where we want to sample, what portion of environment we want to sample, and when it will be measured. So basically, we need to plan what we want to represent from the data. So we should start by mapping the remediation zones, as Steve discussed earlier, or the areas or portions of environment for which separate conclusions are desired. And this will ensure that adequate data is collected from each such area to support the evaluation. For example, taking sediment or pool water samples from top 6 inches of sediments prior to and after remedy implementation to evaluate the performance of the remedy. Now, time frames are also very important. So we should consider temporal component during planning to ensure samples taken before and after remediation represent the same seasonal pattern. Because some of the contaminants concentrations are highly dependent on season and related temperature. And methylmercury is an example because its production increases when temperature rises and in anoxic conditions. So comparing methylmercury from early summer prior to remediation and midwinter post-remediation, it could lead to conclusions that are not really related to the remedy performance. So now once the spatial and temporal boundaries are defined, next step is how data will be used to satisfy the objective. So we need to specify how the data will be analyzed and how findings will result into specific action. Are we going to use the statistical summaries or trend analysis to demonstrate the performance over time, and how these findings will be implied? For example, if the target levels are not achieved in the given time frame as expected, then what will be the plan of action? Now, last two steps are to consider uncertainty and designing the monitoring program. And it's very important to think about to have a strong basis for the design of monitoring program and how well it will perform. This can help to avoid consequences of overestimation or underestimation of remedy performance. So here we need to state what percent reduction in contaminant concentration we want to see, or at what confidence level, or what will be the design criteria. And one important thing is timeline. So if we state we want to reduce 25% reduction in contaminant concentration, then when do we expect to see this reduction? As it may not be achieved right after remedy is in place or an year after, so we need to design the program considering timeline. So this plan will have information about types of samples, location of samples to represent the area of interest, frequency and number of samples for each sampling event to achieve the desired confidence. Now, here is an example for monitoring measures, and this table illustrates monitoring objectives and measurements for each baseline, construction, and long-term monitoring. That includes both performance and effectiveness monitoring. And again, the objective for baseline monitoring is to establish the site-specific baseline conditions prior to remedial action. Then during construction, objectives are to meet design criteria and control measures, and then for long-term monitoring, goals are to achieve project-specific remedial action criteria. Then on the right side of the table, these are examples of measures that can be taken, including chemical, physical, and biological parameters to meet the objectives for each monitoring phase. Now, here we have a poll questions. To see how many of you have been involved with fish tissue analysis to monitor remedy performance. So have you been involved in assessing performance based on fish tissue analysis? And if you have been involved, did it include mercury, methyl mercury, and neither? So our poll shows about 74% not involved. So, yeah, and this looks like majority were not involved, and if they used, it was not for mercury or methyl mercury. But fish tissues are often used to monitor contaminant of concentrations in sediments and to monitor sediment remedy performance. And we have an example on our next slide. So this is an example of a confidential site, and this chart shows that mercury concentration in fish tissue on primary y-axis in blue and mercury concentration in the sediments on the secondary y-axis in red over time. And the black dashed line here indicates when remedy was placed, which is capped in this case to compare pre-remedy and post-remedy performance. And here we can see that concentration in sediments were really high prior to the remedy implementation, and shows decrease in concentrations immediately after remedy is in place. However, blue fish tissue data shows that fish tissue concentrations didn't come down immediately after remedy implementation. But we may see changes over time when the concentrations in surface sediments remain low, and then in that case, fish tissue concentrations may go down as well, demonstrating long-term effectiveness of the remedy. So in that case, it could be a good example for the timeline as sediment data reflects decrease in concentrations immediately after remedy implementation. But for fish tissue, we need to wait and see how it responds. And this is all we have for monitoring section. And with this, I will pass back to John.
Hey, thanks, Bhavna. I appreciate that. We're nearing the end now of our 2 hour and 15 minute time slot, so bear with me while I get through just the rest of this. There is one last important aspect, which is our section 8 or chapter 8 of this guidance document that relates to stakeholder concerns, and then I'll get into a summary of today. But very briefly, you know, we've talked a whole lot today about sites and what to do at a site and how to evaluate our remedial alternatives at a site. You've heard us talk off and on maybe about other contributions in a waterway. And this is very important, especially to our stakeholders. When we were working on this document over a three-year period, we had a community stakeholder and a tribal stakeholder both sitting at the table on the team reviewing documents and listening to everything that the scientists were talking about. And, you know, they have messages that they want to send as well that aren't always the same as what we have. And really the stakeholder message is about awareness. In the United States, there's a national public trust doctrine that exists that says state governments must manage and protect certain natural resources for the sole benefit of their citizens, both current and future. And this is a really important idea, especially when we're talking about these remedial decisions at contaminated sediment sites. This section, chapter 8, or section 8 in the document, really identifies a problem that risk reduction alone may not return the resource to a fishable or swimmable condition per the Clean Water Act. There are certainly things in the Clean Water Act and CERCLA and RCRA that really don't match up. So part of our job is to make sure that we're getting the results we need by doing the work that we're doing. And we don't always know what that is unless we have these stakeholders at the table. This chapter also really points out that partnerships are extremely beneficial, and having a long-term view of the watershed is very important. Again, we're not talking about just sites here, but maybe we have multiple sites along a waterway. Maybe we have only two or three sites within a watershed that are kind of far apart, but all have impacts to the same water body. And just like Bhavna just showed us with some of the mercury data, you know, the mercury data at the site can go down pretty quickly in the sediments, but it doesn't necessarily transfer immediately to concentrations in fish tissue, which might be one of our goals. It could be because not enough time has passed, but it also might mean that there are other sources within the watershed that are contributing mercury to the waterway, and these fish are swimming all up and down the waterway and being exposed in other areas other than our site. So again, just cleanup at one site may not get us to the ultimate goal of fishable or swimmable or potable, which is what some of our stakeholders would probably like to see. So we need to think a little bigger. And if you go to slide 76 here, you know, let's look at potentially a watershed view, and understand that these, you know, what we'll call PBTs. I know you heard that earlier in the presentation today. The persistent, the bioaccumulative, and the toxic compounds, they contribute to watershed scale impacts. And as Eric mentioned, you know, fish advisories are often established to protect humans from eating those because we have multiple sources in a waterway and just can't get those concentrations in tissue down. We need to understand that there are other pathways to sediment impacts. And we've mentioned on or brought some of these out today, but groundwater discharge is certainly another one that you don't always think about. There's surface water drainage pathways, other tributaries into a main water body potentially throughout a watershed that can all have impacts that will, you know, kind of everything kind of rolls downhill and will snowball into some of the effects that we see on these larger waterways. These multiple impacts can really affect economics, they can affect recreation, subsistence fishing, you know, for some local communities and tribes. So again, the idea is to think a little bit larger than just your site, at least some, or have those folks at the table that do think that way, and they can kind of keep the scientists who get into weeds a little often sometimes. They can bring them back out and say, is this really worth the money for the overall benefit or worth the effort? And the answer might be no. So again, this last slide here from chapter 8 talks, you know, really kind of gets into the regional ecosystems and understanding that just this remediation of one site may not be enough to protect the entire ecosystem. And the importance, again, of identifying and engaging stakeholders early and often. It's good to have a resource-driven discussion in order to have a cooperative remedy implementation, that's for sure. And helping keep all these ideas on the table is beneficial when discussing, you know, things like parts per billion or parts per trillion concentrations in water or 10 to the minus something risk level. It's real easy to kind of forget about the bigger picture. So the message from our stakeholders is don't stay in the weeds. Think a little bigger. Think about the watershed or the region that you're in and make sure that the work that you're doing is going to have a beneficial impact collectively. So that really does kind of conclude the content of this document that we've put together. And that was a lot. You know, I think everybody deserves to take a deep breath here because we took all that information in. I'm going to hit just a real quick summary of the information and of at least what we think you should take away. And then really hope that you'll go into the document and look further into, you know, just what we scratched the surface of today and really see what this thing has to offer. So in brief, we've talked about a six-step remedy selection framework that's in this guidance. It includes site characteristics, defining remedial zones, and a preliminary screening that Steve talked about this morning. The detailed evaluation of site using site-specific data, the technology assistant guidelines in Chapter 2 that Paul covered today. We went into the last two steps, which is, you know, development of your remedial action alternatives based upon that data-driven assessment. And then finally, an evaluation of those remedial action alternatives that Eric talked about today. We've provided you or showed you how to find anyway the worksheets to compile and compare site-specific information and retain it for yourself right on your desktop. We've talked about monitoring considerations today that Bhavna just covered here, which is Chapter 7 of the document, And lastly, again, I've gone over some kind of public and tribal stakeholder viewpoints that we feel are important for y'all to keep in mind. The technology overviews, we talked about those today, that link you to recommended or relevant publications. They contain the technology assessment guidelines. And I don't know, it probably didn't come through today's presentation, but I have to tell you that these tags, these guidelines that we developed took, months, if not up to a year, to develop and get consensus on between all the groups and different parties that were there. So these are really well-vetted guidelines that I feel are one of the hallmarks of this guidance document. You're not going to find that type of stuff in many other documents, if any. So please use it. We've talked about some of the advantages of this guidance, it being online and interactive. You just point, click, and go to where you want to gain information, and hopefully we've shown you how to do that today without, reading page after page after page of information that you may not want to be reading. We have these evaluation or the selection evaluation criteria driven by site-specific data. We feel that's very important. We do cover at least all the remedial technologies available at the time of publication, as Paul mentioned earlier. This was published in 2014, and I know there are some small advancements, especially in the in situ category, kind of an emerging type science, if you will. So do check, as Paul said, and make sure that there's nothing else out there that might be able to help you out. We've given you some case studies, the tags. Really, we hope everything you need to kind of get you started down the right path. And lastly, we think you can and should be able to now identify, evaluate, and apply, like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, the information that we've provided, and really make yourself smarter when it comes to contaminant assessment and sediments, and hopefully clean up a few sites along the way. Lastly, we really hope that you'll dive into the document, as I mentioned, look at some of the additional information. Don't hesitate to reach out to me or probably any of our instructors if you have questions. We're certainly here to help you get through the document and provide you the best information we can. And with that, we thank you for your time, and we'll open this up to another question and answer period to hopefully answer anything else you have lingering in your mind. Juliana?
Thanks, John. We have a couple final poll questions as we're finishing up with this training course today. So thank you all for in advance for your answers to those poll questions. Everyone is welcome to send questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. And if you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute. You're welcome to jump in with a question. I do want to point out our links to additional resources. So this goes to a Clue-In page that will continue to be available for you. So this is a great resource that pulls together several of the links that we talked about today. Also, your feedback is very important, and we do use it. So we appreciate everyone taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. If you're interested in a participation certificate, the feedback form is how you get that. So you fill out the feedback. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended today's class, and the system's going to generate a certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because right now the only way to get that certificate is by filling out the feedback form. If you have multiple people at your location, you first person can fill it out, and then the next person can go back and fill it out again with that person's name. So you can have individual certificates for attending, even if you attended with a group today. We'll get to as many questions as we can as they come in. A question has come up. Certainly, we would want most water bodies and their sediments to be fishable, swimmable. In your experience, have any of you worked on a site where the regulatory entity or the state rule required that sediments be designated as residential or commercial industrial?
I think Steve Clough and I both tried to answer that question online. And as a regulator, I'll say no to that. I don't, at least in my jurisdiction here in Delaware, we don't classify sediments as residential sediments or commercial sediments. Certainly the facilities in the uplands, that's pertinent. But when it's in the sediment, it's more driven by the ecological risk or the ecological exposure. It does get into human health risk clearly through the consumption of contaminated fish, and that tie has to be made. But at least initially, it's more about the ecological risk than classifying it as a certain use. somebody else.
Yeah, there may be recreational uses that can be evaluated as well. So you could have a, you know, beach or, you know, wading scenarios and things like that, but it would not be commercial or residential. But you could develop site-specific, you know, exposure scenarios to evaluate direct contact, human health, direct contact with those sediments.
In that interactive tool, is the data entered online? If so, can you address the privacy concerns of entering information onto an online form?
Julianne, we made those worksheets downloadable, so they'll be, and actually you can't enter the information through the web version. I think there are blank versions in the document, but you need to download the worksheets. So they're contained right on your desktop with whatever privacy settings you want to put to them. I assume
Thank
that's
you.
What we were being asked about were the worksheets.
Yep, that's what I'm thinking. So we have just a couple of more minutes for questions, so I'm waiting for some more questions to come in. While we're waiting, looking at the poll results, would you recommend using the framework described today? And we have 86% saying yes, and others are unsure, they need to learn more. So we do encourage everyone to use this guidance document. We hope that it's something that you can use on the job after today's class. And then thinking
Absolutely.
About the project.
I was going to point out, Juliana, that just a reminder to these folks, too, that our guidance document will direct you to other guidance documents that get into some of the details of the technologies as well, maybe some of the sampling and analysis that we've been asked about some today. So that information is housed within the document in each of the technology overview sections. So it is a good one-stop shop to drive you to other things.
Thank you. Question has come in for post-capping monitoring. What are the monitoring parameters and what are the time periods recommended in general?
For capping, I think it will depend on physical. First, it can be planned for just check the physical integrity of the cap, and then it will again then depend upon what's been approved by the regulators. If you end up doing chemical monitoring, then definitely contaminant of concern, and would be the parameters I would say. If the physical integrity of cap is compromised, that may trigger chemical performance monitoring.
Yeah, I think we often see poor water monitoring associated with caps, and that poor water monitoring could include, you know, monitoring below the cap and within the cap, or different depth intervals within the cap, so you can evaluate the, you know, the effectiveness of the cap at isolating the contaminants. If you monitor the surface of the cap, you can be, you know, poor water can be impacted by newly deposited sediment or surface water. So it's better, I think, to monitor kind of within the cap to show that your cap is effectively containing the contamination.
Do trainers have any good reference for costing the various remedial approaches?
I mean, cost is such a site-specific thing.
Yep.
I mean, there is EPA cost FS costing guidance out there, but, you know, trying to, I mean, really you have to come up with site-specific quotes for, you know, for capping material and removal and transport of material and things like that. So it, I think it is really a site-specific determination.
There are no replacement for good experience in developing cost estimates and having been through these projects. So not really a simple thing to be able to provide some guidance to people on.
Thank you. We are about out of time for today's class, so I'd like to go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If we have not addressed your question either online or out loud,